Good evening. I am Elena Kalinowska, Director of Public Programs and Education. And it is my pleasure to welcome you tonight to meet the artist talk with Ronnie Horn. Ronnie Horn works across many media, including sculpture, drawing, photography, language, and site-specific installation to explore issues of gender, identity, androgyny, and the complex relationship between object and subject. Tonight, she discusses her recent projects. The Hirschhorn Museum is fortunate to have one work by Ronnie Horn in our collection, Sometimes Group M, from 1999 to 2000. It is a set of four photographs of the Thames River in London, part of a larger series of 80 photographs. The work is currently on view in the Dark Matters, an exhibition that brings together work from the Hirschhorn collection and that draws upon the association and implications of darkness. This beautiful show that explored darkness on a number of levels, such as mortality, silence, solitude, and loss, have been curated by assistant curators Melissa Ho and Mika Yoshitake. Let's mention just one upcoming event, and it's a very special program coming on May 11. It's a happening which marks the culmination of Doug Aiken's Song 1 and includes a free afternoon symposium and live performances from 8 p.m. to midnight. Tickets are now on sale for the evening event visit, and you can look at our website for more details. If you haven't seen Song 1, curated by Kerry Brower, Chief Curator and Deputy Director, please stick around. It's turned on after sunset and it's on until midnight on the outside of the Hirschhorn Museum. It'll be closed after May 13. I'd like to thank two individuals who make this program possible. They put enormous amount of effort into it and vision. And it's Sarah Gordon of Exhibitions and Jenny Leahy of Public Programs Departments. Now to Ronnie Horn. Ronnie Horn was born in New York in 1955 and lives and works in New York. She received a BFA from the Rhode Island School of Design and an MFA from Yale University. She explores the mutable nature of art through sculptures, works on paper, photography, and books. She describes drawing as the key activity in all of her work, because drawing is about composing relationships, she says. Horn drawing concentrate on the materiality of the objects depicted. She also uses words as the basis for drawings and other works. Horn often crafts complex relationships between the viewer by installing a single piece on opposite walls, adjoining rooms, or through series of buildings. Since 1975, Horn has been traveling to Iceland, whose landscape and isolations have strongly influenced her practice. She received CalArts Alpert Award in the Arts, several national endowments for the Arts Fellowship, and a Guggenheim Fellowship. She has had solo exhibitions at the Art Institute of Chicago, Center George Pompidou, Deer Center for the Arts, Whitney Museum of American Art, Tate Modern, ICA in Boston, among others. Her group exhibitions include Whitney Biennale, Documenta, Venice Biennale. Felix Gonzalez Torres, a remarkable artist who died of AIDS, described her work as everything a good poem is, precise with no baggage, nothing extra. Please give a warm welcome to Ronnie Horn.
Thank you very much. It was lovely. So we're going to douse the lights, this one especially. Thank you. I thought I'd dedicate this talk, since I've been coming out in public so rarely, to water, and specifically a couple of projects, very large-scale projects, actually. In the Hirshhorn, there is a kind of a fragment of a work, which is the subgroup from Some Thames. Some Thames is, in fact, 80 images taken of the surface of the Thames River in London, all taken in central London. And I always love that idea that you could photograph something which, you know, here you are in the center of an urban environment, and here is this extraordinary wilderness, if only in the sense of unknown. And as I developed this project and started to develop the photographic content, which was more than just the image, I became very much engaged with the sense that water is truly one of these unknowable things, visible but unknowable. And yes, we can get a chemistry on it, and we can get an analysis on it, and we can understand it physically and so on and so forth, but it doesn't begin to add up to the psychological experience of water. It doesn't begin to add up, whatever analysis you apply to water, to what it looks like, how it behaves, how it affects us. And the Thames, of course, is especially interesting river because its title, it is lethal, which really fascinated me. So it's always been a river that is dark in its nature, not just, you have to wonder whether part of it isn't English culture. Maybe a little bit of the weather, you know, it's always this kind of bland weather and it just makes you crazy. But, you know, the Thames is a river that attracts suicides from around the world. I mean, people will travel to the Thames to kill themselves. And it's a fact that really fascinates me. You know, nobody comes to the Hudson to kill themselves. You know, you can get murdered and thrown in, but you don't, like, get, you know, leave Canada, come down to the Hudson and kill yourself. So here's the Thames in all its variety. I always think there's a kind of endlessness to the identity. It's somehow magically inclusive of everything. And what I want to show you, and what is key to this work, is how it's installed. When it's fully kind of realized, it's installed. It's intended for a single-use building. In this case, Northern Iceland, there's a University of Akureyri. And I was invited to install the work in these new buildings. And so it's actually quite a lovely building. And it's designed so that throughout the year, obviously the winter, which is pretty rough, people are walking through these glass corridors through all parts of... Throughout the day, you know, you have your refectory, your library, your offices, your research center is all connected by these offices. So you walk in, and we start the river. And here you can see that the extent of the installation is throughout private offices, infrastructure, refectory, classrooms, halls, restrooms. And in this sense, what I am drawn to is that a person using the building will never really have the full scale of the building. You know, you just keep coming back in. Let's say the cleaning lady's using it. She's going to have one route through it. She's going to know it one way. A student will know it another way. An office worker yet another way. And even if you said, well, I'm going to find every one of them, it would be a very difficult thing to do because of the, in a sense, the nebulousness of the project. So in this sense, it's a monumental work without scale. So obviously, in the context of the Hirshhorn presentation, it's much more, you know, when you see only a group of four, what you're really looking at is what's visible about water. And water is something that has the quality to take you around the world. You just sit yourself in front of it and you travel, you know, whether it's your sink, a river, any body of water will, certainly for me, it has an effect of instantaneous travel. So we get getting a little trip through the university. And one of the things I like about the installation is you can go into the most mundane settings, and it doesn't. I don't discriminate. Here you're entering the library, or here you are with the Xerox tools. I like this kind of leveling of the use of space, so the work flows through the building with only the possibility of an individual getting the whole thing. And I'll walk you out. And into another installation, same work, but here we've installed it in the Art Institute in Chicago, which was an extraordinary privilege to have the opportunity to work in a museum of this scale and quality. And the curator was able to help me realize the work in roughly 30 rooms of 20th century painting. So working with different curators, I was able to run the piece throughout these different artworks and architectural settings, including de-installing works so that I could create, you know, a flow. So again, the infrastructure is always a fabulous place to punctuate the work. And I apologize for the quality of the imagery, but, you know, we're all used to Microsoft and the degradation of the visual environment. And, well, here we have the Sahara. This is an aerial view. And here we have a juxtaposition that I'm very fond of with Magritte's painting and yet another juxtaposition I'm very fond of, which is this Baltus painting, which is certainly quite suggestive, as is this image. I don't think that when I installed the work I was looking for a point-counterpoint relationship. It was quite instinctual. Some of it made extreme visual sense, and some of it made sense only by the distance it kept from the neighboring images. Here's the Picabia. More Giacometti. You have lots of Giacometti down here, and the Art Institute has quite a beautiful holding as well. And here, too, what became fascinating when I was installing it, I had a wonderful experience with the guards, who were at first extremely, not hostile, but extremely reticent about my coming in and altering the environment in which they worked on a daily basis, and which at the Art Institute is mostly the permanent collection. It's pretty much a static installation. But when it was fully installed, here's a beautiful library. A number of guards came up to me and started to talk to me about the piece and how, you know, it's interesting that, you know, you took that Picasso away, which I loved, but now I see the Matisse differently because I put the water image next to this Matisse or whatever, and now they, so it was like a kind of an education in a sense, or a reviewing or a re-seeing of the work that they'd been living with. Can't go. This is kind of greasy image I kind of reserved for Soutine, one of my absolute favorites. And a lot of this was going on in my head. And I'm not sure that there's any connection visually, but psychologically for me, it just was like absolutely had to do it. And there weren't too many opportunities to get into the back rooms, unfortunately, in a way that was meaningful to somebody who was visiting. but there was a few occasions. Well, there's one of the Picassos that got away, because the Art Institute had dozens of Picassos, and I thought, you know, there are just too many Picassos. This is getting out of hand. So I got that under control. And it's interesting how the water kind of it toggles between abstraction or realism, depending on where you place it. I love that George O'Keefe in the hallway there. And here on the left is a Katharina Fritsch in the Contemporary Galleries, and you just get a snippet of a Warhol on the right. And those are actually real people in the middle. And here again, real people with the Katie Noland. Because it does sort of look like a Dwayne Hansen situation, doesn't it? So. And then I'll walk you out through the river. There's no getting away from it. And what you've seen as I move you through these images, perhaps too quickly, is about 50% of some Thames. So much for some Thames. Now, it is a work. It's nice to stand in the dark and talk. I always feel like I'm at an advantage here. There are many works dealing with water in my work. There's a work, Another Water, which uses the same images as some Thames. There's a work, Still Water, again the same images, but what I've done is I've taken those images and I footnoted them. And along the bottom of these images you have a series of footnotes. And the footnotes become a whole nother, much more self-reflexive interior space that water also provokes. But let me take you, instead of going on and on about this Thames thing, take you to a more recent project from 2007. I opened a permanent commission in Iceland under the aegis of Art Angel, which is an English art organization that actually commissions artists to do the work they want to do where they want to do it. So not in museums or galleries, but actually space or location-specific work. And so here, what you've got. Now, this is a town about 3 hours north of Reykjavik. I'd been there in the early 80s, and I had seen this building, which sort of looks like a combination gas station lighthouse. And it was at the top of this town, which was amazing. It was like the prime real estate, and it was a library. And I just fell in love with that. I thought for sure it would be a church or something much more symbolic, but the idea that it was a library made me feel like this was a town that I could respect. Unfortunately, the library was not functioning anymore, and Art Angel was able to take effectively buy the building, and we then turned it into what I would call, it's called Library of Water. It's basically a community center, and it has quite a number of different aspects to it, including a writer's residency. We've had Ann Carson, Rebecca Solnit, Ellen Siksu, and a number of fabulous younger Icelandic artists there producing new work. But it's also a fairly large project wherein I actually renovated the building to enable it to serve my purposes as well, which was a public artwork. This is called Water Selected, and what you're looking at are 24 glass, floor-to-ceiling glass columns, each one filled with a unique glacial source of water. And I thought I'd just, here you see the origin of the water throughout Iceland, all the major glaciers, and some of which are very near to being history, including one of my kind of the glacier that, to end all glaciers. See if I can figure out how this thing works. Then, yeah. which is this little tiny thing right here, which is where Jules Verne said he climbed down to get to the center of the Earth. But the problem is there's a glacier on it, so obviously that's just not true. But right over here, we have Sticky Somer, which is where your library water is. And right down here, you have the entrance to Hell, which is Hecla. So you've really got all access points covered there in a very limited amount of terrain. Some of the beauties of Iceland, we went, traveled throughout Iceland to collect the water. These were the settings it was collected from. These are my boys who are like choreographers. They danced across the surface of everything. And we collected ice. One of my favorite sources in the interior. Filthy. Awesome. All your ice. Here we have the ice in the fish factory refrigerator, which is where we kept it frozen, because we were collecting an enormous amount of ice from all these different sources. And then we eventually began melting the ice, archiving it, and brought it to the Library of Water, where we loaded it into the columns. The green spots are your locations for the different columns of water. And so here we go into the library in earnest. And it's open. It's open 24 hours a day. It's equipped with airport, so you go up there and, you know, either meditate or work, whatever it is you're inclined to. Very quiet, obviously. Quite an extraordinary view in every direction. And one of the things the columns do is they fold the surrounding landscape into the room, which is just, for me, a very beautiful experience to see it so kind of delicately wrapped into the room, drawn into the room. And at the bottom of these columns, although it's not visible, you had these beautiful landscapes that formed over the first year of the existence of the installation, which was just the precipitate that was in the water filtering down to the bottom of the column. And you can see here the different densities and colors of the water, which are just a natural occurrence. The water is being taken from ice that could be quite a few hundred years old, and certainly different degrees of sediment and types of sediment in the ice. We're on our way out of the Library of Water now. We get a little kind of Baroque moment there. And there is the city lights of Sticky Somer reflected in the columns. And that's the end of the visual part of this talk. We could have some lights, and I would be happy to take some questions, if there are any. Usually there are no questions because I seem to answer them all. The columns have a little light above, which comes on in the evening towards dusk.
Yeah. How did you choose how to fix that?
Like drawing, just intuitively. There was no logic. It was done empirically. Yeah. Yes.
In the tense work, when you encounter it as a book, the text, I think, adds
this whole
element.
Yeah, you know, I just... There were so many angles I could take on this talk, and I did actually bring this book, Another Water, and I thought I'd do some reading from it, you know? But it's really depressing. And I thought, you know, we got so much shit going on in the world. I thought, you know, you don't need to hear this crap. You know, it's got all these dead body reports in it about people who threw themselves in the river. Here, I'll read you one. It's completely depressing. You'll love it. And actually, this dead body report, so this is the book, Another Water. You've got your footnotes here, and you've got your the same images you've been looking at. When I was researching the Thames Project, and this was the original incarnation of all the water projects that came subsequently. So this is dead body report. Now what I did was I took, what I've done basically is a parody of a police report, which I was not supposed to see. But I think the cop who shared them with me didn't realize that I wasn't supposed to see them. So anyway, I did base this dead body report in format, in language, on what I had read. Now, the actual details, the name, for example, is changed for obvious reasons. But the facts are basically the same. So it's just a short story, basically. Dead body 57.95. So that's the 57th dead body in the year 1995. Michael David Parker, 29 years old, actor, 5'10", well-nourished Caucasian male. Straight, short-cropped, light brown hair, greenish eyes, facial stubble, slim, muscular build, own teeth. Yellow polo neck shirt with extensive tears in the upper half, dark blue corduroy gap trousers zip open. Leather belt with yellow metal buckle unbuckled. Green socks, black commando style half boots, size 10. Pinky ring, copper colored with horseshoe engraving. The last living evidence of Mr. Parker was the phone call he made to the speaking clock at 3:22 a.m. This is the only record that Mr. Parker was alive at this time. The body, initially mistaken for a pile of rags, was found in the Thames near an underground generating center. A noose had been tied around the neck, and a long length of rope remained attached. The noose was tied in a complex knot. The rope had been cut halfway through. The other half was torn. Mr. Parker's hands and wrists were bound in an elaborate manner with a layer of red insulation tape and string. This was covered with a layer of white tape. The fingers of each hand were bound together tightly, leaving only the thumbs free. The end of the white roll of tape was still attached to the left hand. Mr. Parker's possessions were found near the power station on a ledge of the jetty. The ledge, almost inaccessible, is only 6 inches wide and requires much agility to reach. The noose was tied to the metal walkway approximately 40 feet above the river. Mr. Parker's possessions consisted of a freshly sharpened kitchen knife, chef's size, a number of different prescription medications in large quantities, and more tape. Mr. Parker had just been chosen for the part of Edgar Allan Poe in a play based on the life of the writer. Recently, he had spoken to the author of the play about dropping the part of Poe and replacing it with a role in which he would play himself. So that was the beginning of my commitment to the project. And the research took me into the culture of the English in a very interesting way, because one of the things you learn about the Thames is that it really is a dumping ground for dismembered body parts. And I say that, there's something humorous about it, but the reality is that the English do have an extraordinary tradition of not merely killing somebody, but taking them to pieces, skinning them, all these kind of horrific things going on, and it all just winds up in the Thames. So that was one layer of meaning in Another Water or Still Water. And then you had more lyrical footnotes that might take you in another direction. I can give you a little sampler, a little medley of let's see if I can find something here that's a little. It could start at the beginning, but it's the way this thing is written. You could start with any footnote, and it's run in a loop. It's written in a kind of litany, sort of very like stream of conscious, but then also broken up with facts, sometimes disturbing, sometimes funny, or quotations from Emily Dickinson, Joseph Conrad, or Kurt Weill. So here, if we start with an image, you got to see the images, but all right. First footnote reads, a rat surrendered here. See poem number 1340, Emily Dickinson. A corpse, especially one found in a river, is likely to be turgid, but the water itself, at least in this river, is definitely turbid. What does water look like? See aspic. Water sighs, water sucks, water licks, water laps, water splishes, water splashes, water splashes, water washes, water swashes. Water sloshes, water murmurs, water hushes, water rushes, water gushes, water burbles, water babbles, water gurgles, burbles, water sucks. When you see a reflection in water, do you recognize the water in you? Say it's a river, I can believe that, but when you say it's water, I get suspicious. Is the Thames a case of mistaken identity? When you say water, what do you mean? When you say water, are you talking about the weather or yourself? I'm trying to skip over the footnotes that don't reference the image itself. Here's an interesting story. A young Parisian woman came to London recently to drown herself in the Thames. It's curious how the Thames attracts people from far away. She was very upset about the death of her father, and apparently she had bad teeth. Incidental note is made of the fact that she did not have buck teeth. This was an interesting story that I picked up in a newspaper at the time I was researching about a woman who threw herself in the Thames. And she left a note for her, she left a note in French in her hotel room. And when her sister, when it was translated, basically talked about the loss of her father and talked about the fact that she thought her teeth protruded too much. But in this police report, they mentioned the fact that she didn't have buck teeth, so it was just this really obviously low self-esteem issue, and it was just quite riveting to me. It's like this guy getting rid of the Edgar Allan Poe part. And there was another suicide, which was a blind person whose parents had taught him to speak a language that only his parents could speak. And, you know, if you can imagine that that's all you've got to communicate, it's just, you know, a kind of dead end. And there were a lot of stories like that. But then this was cut with some poetic material. You know, you're just going to have to get the book. It was a bestseller years ago. It's been reissued. This is the second edition. So that's that side of the water, the inside of the water. Any other questions?
Can I ask you to speak a little bit about how you chose to compose these shots?
Sure. Really simple. We rented a tugboat, and we built a scaffold on the tugboat to a certain height. And I wanted to mimic, with the camera, I wanted to mimic the view of somebody looking at the water as they walked along the river, right? So we kept the, we had four cameras on this scaffold. We were probably about 25 feet off the surface of the water, and we had a fixed angle. And we would keep it fixed throughout the entire shoot. And that's what, yeah.
And the experience of the whole series, it's interesting that there's no beginning and there's no end.
Right.
It's an infinite time. And of course, you see many different moods and colors with the water. I'm wondering, how long was the period of creation? How long was the...
Yeah, well, I started, I guess... we did the actual photography in two different seasons so I could get take advantage of the different qualities of light, and each photo shoot was about 2 weeks, 10 days to 2 weeks. There was a lot of downtime because we were still working with film at that point, and it was very, very hard to get what we needed to take a shot. And shooting in sunlight is not... Not, it's not characteristic of that area, but it's also not really desirable. So it was a very, very fine line to get the material. We shot a hell of a lot of material to get the images, and then they've only... they had a special film that you could shoot it at a very high ASA. You could push the hell out of it in processing, which is what we did. Yeah.
What was the geographic span along the river that you traversed?
When I originally went to there to look at the project or consider the project, I went up and down the full length. I just was interested in every aspect. But really, in the end, I was most fascinated by central London, and I stayed in central London. Yeah. Kind of moseying around all the bridges there and shooting... the part of the river really that most people are familiar with, if they're down, you know, going to the Tate in that area. And I love the idea that I just took a tiny section of the river and I exploded it into, you know, hundreds of possibilities, you know. So. Yeah.
I just wanted to ask more, I guess, in terms of. You, a lot of your work, I think there's, you pointed out this idea of paradox as something that's important to you.
Yeah.
And, there's this double effect that happens experientially when there's, with the reflection, when you just put it, you see yourself in the reflection. There's a lot of associations within that reflection. But then at the same time, you kind of lose yourself into this vortex. And so I just wondered what...
Yeah, when you see your reflection in water, do you recognize the water in you? I mean, that is kind of a key, or let's say an important part to my relationship to water and the possibility of doing this work, or imagining that it could be a rich enough adventure visually to sustain this scale of event, you know. The big paradox about water is no matter how familiar it is to you, it remains unknown. And that just, I just, exactly the kind of thing that keeps me connected. Yeah.
I've got a couple of questions.
Yeah.
Among suicides who decide to undertake a pilgrimage to the Thames to actually off themselves, does the reputation of the river exist mainly visually or narratively? Like, is it someplace that they've been before and they see it and it makes them think that's the place, or is it just that it's a legend?
You know, I don't have an answer for that, but I would say that when I went there, you know, and I was actually originally commissioned, which normally I don't do commissions, but I thought, went over there, and they wanted to commission artists to do something connected to the Thames, because they're redeveloping the Thames, the real estate along the Thames. And the first thing I was fascinated by was the fact that this looks filthy. This river looks filthy, and they're going to make all these expensive apartments with this view onto this filth. And I thought... that's a little strange. But as I spent time looking at this river, I found myself totally riveted by it. And I really began to understand it doesn't make a difference how filthy water is. It is magnetic, you know. I was just recently reading a book about a slum in Mumbai, and the presence of water, which is usually in the form of sewage, you know, but yet the proximity of people to the water, regardless of the fact, is fascinating to me. So I found myself mesmerized by this water, not only the darkness. That's the first thing. It is an opaque river in the sense that it's very, it's got a lot of, because it's tidal and it's going up and down every day, and it moves very quickly because the embankments are built in, so it's really kind of upped the volume flow. It's full of dirt, so it has very, very low visibility. And then most of these dead body reports were notable because the body would go in and wouldn't come out. Then, you know, 2 weeks later, it'd be in some location 20 feet from where it went in, right? So it's really a very violent river. What I don't know, you know, you could read. I doubt these people are reading Dickens or Conrad or all of. I mean, it is a very it is a river with a lot of literary reference, and but I don't have an answer for that. Whether they saw it and they thought, well, because you know, you look at the Seine, you can't kill yourself in the Seine. I mean, just forget it. You know, I went around looking at rivers actually when I did this project because I was fascinated by how. Well, the number of suicides in the river, or what is called death by misadventure, which I love, an English expression. Jumpers, the commonness of people jumping off those bridges. Well, one of the issues is there's extreme accessibility. There are a lot of bridges, they're easy to get onto, and they're easy to jump off. So that's one. It's not like the Golden Gate, it's not that intimidating. You're not, you know, 100 feet up. So there's that. There is a reputation in the Thames that it's lethal, so you could be sure if you go in, it's really likely you're not going to come out. And I would think if you're going to commit suicide, you know, you'd want to know that you're not going to come out. An interesting thing about this type of suicide, you're not just dying, you're disappearing. It's like a double, you know, negative. You're disappearing. In some cases, bodies don't come back for months, and at which point they can't identify it. You know. So. Yeah.
You mentioned that your four cameras were in fixed positions.
Yes.
So you removed the element of choice in framing. How about in timing?
Well, I didn't remove the element of framing and choice because I was always picking my shots. There was a lot of water to look at, and there was a lot of it that didn't seem as interesting to me as, you know, other parts, whether it was the light or it was the turbulence or whatever it was, you know, that drew me to it. So I was definitely picking my shots. What was the question? Timing?
Well, yeah, you had your cameras at fixed angles, so you weren't cleaning that. So you removed the element of choice as to where you're going to plant the cameras already.
Well, I fixed that relationship, absolutely, yeah, yeah.
So you are choosing when to shoot.
Exactly. It was about, a lot of it was about the quality of the light. A lot of it was about the texture of the water, you know? Very kind of elusive, and in many cases what I was photographing looked like nothing, and I was actually fascinated, you know. I wasn't after a strong graphic experience. I never am. For example, I would never describe myself as a photographer, you know, in the sense that, you know, first of all, I can't do one photograph. It's got to be like 100, you know. Well, there's something weird about that. It must be like the influence of sculpture or drawing or something. I mean, that's a beautiful picture, right? But that's not enough for me. That doesn't work for me. That's just a description of water. You know, I'm not interested in descriptions. When photographic material is, and it frequently is descriptive, you know. So, yeah.
Are you currently working on any projects that carry on the subject of water or the
Yeah, probably, but you know, I never know. I prefer not to know, actually. Well, I like the idea of going to... I always wanted to footnote another river. So I was thinking, what other river? And the Mississippi comes to mind in a big way. But that is an enormous... And I actually went down to New Orleans. This was years ago. I just got excited. Oh, I got to go down there and check this situation out, you know. And of course, it was in August. You know, and it was so hot. Two in the morning, I'd be walking along the Mississippi feeling like I was wrapped in cellophane. It was just, you know, appalling. So I wound up staying in the hotel, which was air conditioned, and I had the view over the Mississippi. And I started writing footnotes. I never pushed it to the point of realizing another, but you know, you can think about a project like that, you can go around the world footnoting water. And I'm, you know, that is definitely something that's stayed with me all these years as something that would be meaningful to do. And I think it would be a discovery process all the way for me. So. More interested, actually, in the visual, yes, but what does this water inspire? When I started writing the Mississippi footnotes, it was a completely different focus than the Thames, you know. So more about the toxicity of water, because, you know, down in New Orleans, you've got all this oil refinery type situation. And New Orleans has its own darkness, period. You know, it's definitely a culture that has a lot of shadow in it. And the water picks that up. So, and the Mississippi's got a lot of shadow in it, if only geologically. Because it's just moving all over the place. They can't control it. They've just fucked it up. The Army Corps of Engineers, they've tried to... And the Mississippi isn't having it. And you see that fight going on, which is fascinating, too. The Thames is really much more tame, you know, and it's much more going vertical into the English culture.
So. Have you ever explored the Seine?
Explored the Seine. I visually only. Yeah, I didn't get... It didn't appeal to me to go into it in great depth. The part of the Seine that I was looking at seemed quite pastoral to me, and there were parts of the Thames as well that were, you know, you get up around Cambridge and Oxford, it's quite pastoral. And, you know, it was interesting because it wasn't interesting to me at all. So I left, you know. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, you talked a little bit about not being interested in description in terms of the properties, and then this notion of repetition
of
something in sequence. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about You Are the Weather.
Yeah. You Are the Weather, which is an installation which I did in 1995 and again in 2012. It's a kind of a portrait of a woman. I spent about 6 weeks traveling around Iceland photographing her in all the hot water spots of Iceland. So it was all outside. And they're all kind of close-up shots, just headshots of her in sequences. And then they're installed, so they're 100 shots is one piece. They're installed on four walls of room. So you're surrounded by this woman who's basically staring at you. You know, you're being voyeurized by her. Which I love that idea, because it seemed to inspire a lot of kind of erotic content on the part of the critics. And I remember being referred to as a guy. I thought that was interesting. Of course, if you have this very eroticized woman, you assume the photographer is male. So that was an interesting angle. And then another critic was interested in whether I was the lover of this person. So those things became... The truth of the matter is, I'm not going to tell you whether I was a lover or not, but the truth of the matter is that there was an extraordinary intimacy. I was shooting her with an ultra-long telephoto lens, so I was way the hell away from her. And she was in the water, in her own little space. you know. And I was photographing quite a lot just to get a grouping, a sequence that would kind of capture that sense of place wherever she was. See, the original idea of You Are the Weather was part of Two Place, which is a series of books I've been developing since 1990. It's kind of an ongoing project. The sixth volume or so was something called Harold's Daughter, which is the name of this woman, which I like very much because it's oddly anonymous. It's the daughter of Harold, and there are hundreds of them in Iceland, so that's this person. And the idea was that you would photograph, stay on this woman's face and photograph her in a setting that was extremely kind of really profoundly typical of Iceland, which is hot water, meaning naturally heated water in daylight. And, you know, it's very rare to have access to these situations. And could I get at some sense of place through this woman's face? That was my question to myself. Could I do that? And I always knew that I was putting it into this context of books called Two Place, which are all based in my dialogue with Iceland. So I knew you would have that kind of frame. It would be set into that frame. So in a way, I wouldn't say the 100 images became a narrative. I don't think there's any story being told, but there is an act being committed somehow of identity. An act of identity. Now, I can't tell you what the identity is, but I can tell you that that's the dynamic I was trying to cultivate with the viewer. Yeah.
I read a bit about your interest in investigating androgyny beyond the representation of the figure necessarily. Can you say a little bit about that?
Well, you know, I don't have an analytical relationship to that. Oh, look at that. I discovered my microphone here. You know, my mother gave me this name, Ronnie. And I remember when I was a kid, I'm thinking, you know, what is this name? You gave me this name. I'm getting all these letters, Mr. Ronnie Horn, you know? And I discovered that I had that option just through very, you know, just intuitively that I could go either way in terms of how people looked at me. I'm not saying that I decided to masquerade in an androgynous way. I think it's quite a part of what my sensibility is. But what came first, I don't know. You give somebody this name and they have this insight. You know, one person will stay whatever gender they've been assigned. But I don't identify strongly in either direction, male or female. I still don't, you know, so it's very natural for me. I don't claim androgyny. It's just I'm very much in an in-between space, and I'm very comfortable there. So, you know, it enters into my work, obviously, in so many ways.
Yeah.
So it's really kind of my element.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I'm not sure I ever showed it, Carnegie. Are you sure it was there?
Yeah, the one you show is, you know, you are given a very long, stretched hallway like space, and then you put the electric line from beginning to end, and you put one high heel on the floor.
Yeah, I think you're thinking about a different horn.
But that's not your horn, right?
No, I don't think so. My memory's getting bad, but I don't remember anything with high heels yet.
Okay,
it happens all the time. I think you have Rebecca Horn on that one. Yeah, I think so.
Oh, yeah. That's right. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking of fluidity of identity, this is the other thing. I found it very interesting. The same work in the university and in the art exhibition in Chicago. It's very different. I mean, both public spaces and public slash private to some degree.
Yeah.
Different social spaces. And it must have been very interesting to you. I'm not sure if it was the university that you did first.
Yes.
And then Chicago.
Yes.
I just wonder if you could talk a little bit more about that. Were there things that surprised you about how the work changed depending on the architecture and the social space that it's occupying?
Yeah. I'm not sure it changed much. Obviously, the work placed in the context of visual art emphasizes the visual aspect of the work. And I think when it was placed in the university, you would have people who didn't know they were looking at art, so you could get rid of that element. So you just had this mysterious visual, you know, like a chemist or a nurse, somebody studying to be a nurse, or a, I don't know, somebody cooking food in the refectory, you know, people who weren't expecting to see anything. So you really had the chance to offer an experience because it's so unexpected. And I love that idea.
It does seem, even just looking at the documentation, that in the shots of the university, I was focusing much more on thinking about myself moving through the space and seeing what the other people were doing.
Yes.
Looking, I mean, of course, it's a static photograph of a situation rather than being in the situation directly. But the Gombrich thing kind of came through for me with the compare-contrast, you know, like
The problem with the photographs is what you have, you can't see it. If I stand back and go for the whole room and you can see a flow through of many images, and one of the tricks in the Chicago installation was to try to keep a visual continuity. So if you stand here and you're looking at one image of water next to whatever, the Picasso, and on the other side of the room you could see, oh, there's this, and there's another image of water, and you go out the room and there's a, so you see there is a visual continuity that can keep you motivated, let's say. And you had that also with the university building, and I guess that if I can't say one experience was more interesting than another, but I was very excited by working in an audience where art was not, didn't need to be part of the dialogue. It was okay, a visual experience which had, let's say, no other use value than the visual. And I did have interesting feedback, which is, you know, very happenstance. If I was up there visiting, you know, people would come up to me and basically the response was that the environment became more interesting to them because they didn't know what the hell they were looking at, you know.
So. Are there other kinds of buildings or things that you have in mind?
There was one other, and I couldn't find the visual material I wanted to include. It was in an office. It was in Hyatt headquarters in Chicago. They bought the work, and they wanted it installed on one of the floors in one of their buildings. And it was an enormous floor, and it was an open plan of offices. And that was quite interesting because originally, I'd have various, and it was voluntary if an employee didn't want something in their office then. And as I started working on it, a number of employees came up to me and said, I don't want that in my office. Okay. And as I started building it up, you know, through the floor, across the floor, through the rooms, people would come to me and say, yes. You know, so it took a little bit of experience with the work to imagine a relationship to it. So that was quite satisfying and very difficult to install in an open when you have so much glass. But, you know, we were able to do that. Very satisfying. I could imagine in any single-use type building, corporate headquarters, hotel, you have a certain idea of a community around a single-use building, and there's a certain consistency to it, so you can, let's say, extend yourself into the different spaces of a building, infrastructure, so to speak, and main public spaces, semi-private spaces, all of these, so you can keep this vastness of scale beyond the viewer. So, I've also installed it in Folkwang in a number of, in an amazing, I mean, I have amazing collections of art. I mean, you know, it's easy to think, oh God, look at that, she needs a Picasso to look good, you know, that kind of thing. But, you know, I was surprised at how dynamic this sort of abstract image played off of the various time periods and styles and subject matter of the different artists and even the architectural setting, which is not so obvious in the photographs.
It does seem to be an analogy to, you know, every viewer looking into the water as something different reflecting back to them. It's like every word of art that you saw next to reflecting something a little bit different.
Yeah, I definitely think, you know, water is a mirror. Physically it can be, but also psychologically there's no question in my mind. Yeah.
So are these permanent installations, like at the university and at the AIC or even at this corporate headquarters?
Well, you know, permanence is such a, you know, relative term. But University of Akureyri is intended as a permanent installation. Art Institute, it was an exhibition, so it was about 3 or 4 months, and then it was out. And I have no idea whether the owner of the work in Chicago still has it hanging in the offices. There's one thing that happens when you sell your work, it's not yours anymore. And that's, you know, you lose that control.
And how about the library board?
That's, again, permanent as permanent can be. Yeah, it's been there for 5-6 years and go on with it. Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you very much. I think it's...